This is an interview with the President of the General Assembly and Foreign Minister of Namibia, Mr. Theo Ben Gurirab, on November 3rd, 1999, at the UN in New York City. So I'm going to just put this close to you.
First of all, just for general background purposes, could you explain where you were born and where you were educated and when you were first involved with the independence of Namibia?
The biographical data is readily available. I will give you a folio on that. But I was born on 23rd January 1939 in a small railway town 142 kilometers east from Swakopmund, our coastal town. Actually, in my language, the name of the place is Usakos, generally known as Usakos or Usakos. At the time of my growing up, it was the main railway conjunction in the whole of the country. And as I was growing up, I felt that I was actually living in a paradise. Little did I know that I was living in the headquarters of racism, that the communities were divided along racial lines, not only between the whites and the blacks, but also among the different black communities. But it was a fun place at that time to have been growing up in. That is where I started my schooling. Unlike a much larger number of my siblings and cousins, I was one of the fortunate ones who did not go through the rigors of looking after cattle and doing household chores that they were required to do in the village or many settlements in and around Zagos. I was fortunate in the sense that I had early education at a Rhenish missionary school, where I obtained primary education. I did my secondary education and teacher's training at Okahanja, which is about 75 kilometers northwest of Windhoek, the capital city, at a place called Augustinium. It's a place that links in so many different ways the history of Namibia to Reformation led by Martin Luther in Germany many centuries earlier. The people who were associated with setting up that educational and training facility in Namibia were of course Lutherans to begin with, and some money had been made available to those missionaries to set up this school. Its importance for me, more than the connection with the church, is that it was at that time at the point of convergence of all the African students, those who were eligible or who had an opportunity, one way or the other, to attend schooling, to have come together. It was not the intention of the colonial administration, nor was it the intention of the school administration, for that matter. It was economic consideration. It was cheaper to bring all of us together at one place rather than to set up schools and training facilities in different parts of the country.
Okay.
What they had not realized, what initially we did not realize ourselves, was that by this arrangement, it was possible to bring together at one place the future leaders of Namibia from all parts of the country. It was there that most of us met, that became the hub of political consciousness raising in the fullness of time. It was that school, and next to it, not far from there, a Catholic school at Dobra. I'll come back to my early education. It was there that I did my secondary education and teacher's training. I qualified as a teacher in 1960, but chose to go to Walvis Bay, our harbor town, to work in fishing factories. They paid little more than other job opportunities than open for blacks. My intention was, while I qualified as a teacher, that I wanted to further my studies. I had not thought that it would have been possible for me to have gone abroad, but I had plans that if I had enough money saved, I would find a way to further my studies in South Africa. But politics came into being in the early 60s, late mid-50s, I should say. But in terms of my own participation, from 57 onwards. But actually, the political consciousness raising started while I was at Agostinium between the years 1958 and 1960. The African political resistance movements were being formed, including SWAPO, now the ruling party, others, SWANU and others. From time to time, some of the initial leaders of that process, that movement, would come discreetly at night from Windhoek to the school and then provide education, political education classes, gatherings for us. But it is that it's where it started. African teachers were not allowed by law to participate as if one is generous, as civil servants in political activity. But the pressure was mounting, and we became responsive to the demand that because we were the educated lot among the people, that we should also take a lead in a political mobilization of the people, to talk to the people about what problems there were and what they could do to demonstrate, to protest, and so on. But that's how my political activity started. I had to be discreet, but that was the requirement by law while I was a teacher. But I nevertheless got myself involved in political activities until 1962, when I decided to clandestinely leave the country and found my way up to newly self-governing Tanganyika, which I reached in October 1962.
Okay. Yeah. Now, when you talked about that many of the leaders of Namibia started gathering at the secondary school where you were, did that include Sam Nujoma and Hage Geingob and some of these people?
Not Sam Nujoma, but Hage Geingob, but myself, Idibuwa Mutinya. We came at different times. Hage Geingob and I came together, but there were others ahead of us. Not necessarily the previous generation. I'm talking in terms of when the political activism started. But people who were older than us, who were same generation as we were, but older than us significantly, it would have been Sam Nujoma's age group.
Okay.
But he was a worker, he was not at that school. Our deputy or prime minister, Hendrik Witbooi, who is older than us, was also a teacher there. He got his training there. Eventually, my generation of current Namibian leaders in the government, in parliament, even in the private sector, come from Abyssinia, majority of them.
So then you left in 1962, and where did you go from there? You went to Tanganyika?
Yeah, but it was a long, long journey. I left the country under a false pretense. I cook up a story which succeeded and helped me to where I am now today. The story being that I and my friend who left with me, Jan Bamba Wirap, who live now in Sweden, or shuttles between Sweden and Namibia, was that we were actually natives from, native meaning here nationals, whose countries were not independent, we were not citizens, but nationals of now Malawi, then Nyasaland. And that we had been in Southwest Africa, Namibia, under a contract working in the local factories in Walvis Bay. And that we had overstayed the terms of our contract, but we were good people, but we did not violate any laws, but we were advised that we should leave the country. And we had a friend in the magistrate's office who was very skillful and helpful indeed, who issued us with two sets of documents to that effect. One, a voluntary deportation order with all the appropriate notations on it, and one, a traveling pass, which blacks were required to be in possession of. So on that basis, we left Walvis Bay by train, travel through the rest of the country, through South Africa, through Botswana land, Botswana then not independent, through Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, through Northern Rhodesia, which is now Zambia, up to Tanganyika, which is now Tanzania.
Yeah. Yeah. And when did you become a member of SWAPO?
Actually, at its formation, SWAPO was formed in 1960. I officially became a member in 1961.
Okay.
Yes.
Just for our record.
Yes, sure.
And then when did you first become involved in the United Nations?
In 1963, while I was in Tanganyika, I won UN fellowship. So it was UN Fellowship that brought me to the United States in June 1963 as a student at Temple University in Philadelphia. I could not, English was not our official language, nor was it spoken widely in Namibia at that time. We were required, therefore, initially to do brushing up of the language and science and math courses.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually I ended up being a student at Temba University, where I did my undergraduate in political science and graduate studies in international relations. So I actually, my association, personal association with the country, started in 1963. It continues, I should say.
Yes. Now, SWAPO actually achieved a very unusual status at the UN, became an official observer of the UN. How was that established, and what were the forces that came together to actually establish that status for SWAPO?
Yes. Well, a number of forces. First was that when the Organization of African Unity was founded on the 25th of May 1963, just shortly before I left Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Perhaps within a year of its founding, one of the committees set up by the Organization of African Unity, called the Liberation Committee, actually the full title is the Coordinating Committee for the Liberation of Africa, but it's briefly called the Liberation Committee, which was headquartered in Dar es Salaam, called together the leaders and representatives of all the existing national liberation movements of Africa, of Mozambique, of Angola, of Rhodesia, of even Kenya, Uganda, that were not independent, Guinea-Bissau, all the countries that were not independent, but mostly Eastern, Central, and Southern Africa. And the question was, for these leaders to indicate to the Liberation Committee ways and means by which they, as the people from countries concerned, propose to proceed to find freedom, to achieve freedom and independence for their countries and their peoples. And they were therefore asked, after that initial meeting, to go back and prepare so-called programs of action, setting out the objectives and goals. This was done in order for the Liberation Committee to not only recognize those movements that in their judgment deserve to be recognized and supported, and secondly, and more importantly, to go out through friendly world, independent African countries, other countries of the third world, to mobilize support for those movements. And we did so. SWANU, of which my compatriot you mentioned was one of the prominent members for the two movements. And both of us presented our programs of action. In our case, we said that in addition to the United Nations mobilizing the international community for support and assistance, we would also organize a military resistance body. And that we specifically asked the Liberation Committee and the OAU member states to assist us to train our combatants to launch the armed struggle. SWANU felt that the objective conditions in Namibia and the practicalities of how to get from wherever to Namibia were such that they did not think the time was ripe for launching the armed struggle. Others from Guinea-Bissau also opted for armed struggle in addition to political campaigns and diplomatic activities. But the long and short of it is that was when both SWAPO and SWANO were recognized as befitting support. And we were supported until finally the OAU decided that it was SWAPO that actually was doing most of the campaigning and had gained recognition and support beyond the OAU member states internationally, including by the UN. So that was UN and the OAU went together. So that was one. Secondly, actually on that basis, in 1972, at a summit held in Rabat, Morocco, the OAU decided to actually recognize those liberation movements that in the judgment of the OAU member states as recommended by the Liberation Committee should be supported. Resources were scarce, and therefore OAU felt it did not want to waste money on organizations that did not really bear a chance to make a difference.
Okay.
In case of Namibia, SWANU was not de-recognized per se, but they somehow were not present and didn't do what was expected of them. That recognition, and after that exercise, the OAU in 1972 recognized liberation movements as the sole and authentic representatives of their people and campaigned for recognition, support, assistance with the international community. The OAU member states, therefore, when they came to the UN, in the resolutions of the General Assembly, inserted the action taken by the OAU and initiated a similar action here within the UN and gained support. So it was on that basis that in 1972, SWAPO was recognized as a sole and authentic representative of the Namibian people, and step by step I was directly involved from that point onwards. We reached a point where in the late 70s SWAPO was recognized as the permanent observer, as opposed to an observer in 1972, a permanent observer. There is a difference in quality between the two.
Okay.
And I was eventually provided with a seat in the General Assembly.
Okay, so you became the representative.
I became the representative, yeah. It happened.
So about what year was that?
That was 70. The initial recognition came in 72.
Uh-huh.
But this recognition that elevated SWAPO at the level similar to what countries like Switzerland, the Holy See, represents Vatican, intergovernmental organizations, Organization of American States, Organization of African Unity, and so on.
Okay.
So we enjoyed. It was only SWAPO and the PLO, the Palestine, of the Liberation Movement group that enjoyed that status.
That's right. It was really
only the two of us.
Yeah.
Yes, that was in 78.
Okay, now that then coincides with the resolution 425.
Yes.
So what is the connection? Because it's the same year.
No, there is no direct connection. Maybe heavy coincidence, two things. Because the adoption of resolution 435 started following the election of President Carter in 77. And not so much the election per se, but as a consequence of the election of President Carter, Ambassador Andrew Young became the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Cyrus Vance became the Secretary of State. Richard Moose became the Secretary of State for African Affairs, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
Yes.
And these people had a different approach to African issues than their predecessors.
Yes.
So it was they who initiated consultations among the members of the Security Council, initially the Western members of the Security Council. We have as Western permanent members, US, Britain, and France.
Yes.
But at that time, between 77 and 78, you also had Germany and Canada as non-permanent members.
So it was on the Security
in the Security Council.
Yeah, okay.
Five of them together started what now is known historically as the Western Contact Group for Namibia. Yeah, so we started a long drawn out negotiating process, which eventually culminated in the adoption of Resolution 435.
Now, were you, as a representative of SWAPO, involved in the discussions that eventually formulated the language that went into the resolution?
Yes, I was the principal contact person, principal spokesman.
Oh, okay.
For SWAPO. The Resolution 435, well, it means so many things, but the groundbreaking resolution, the mother of Resolution 435 was adopted in January 1975. It was in that resolution for the first time that the United Nations specifically called for the holding of free and fair elections in Namibia under the supervision and control of the United Nations to give the Namibian people an opportunity to exercise their right to freedom, right to self-determination, freedom, and independence. But there was opposition to it until the election of President Carter's administration. And the process that I have explained. But I was involved also in that resolution 385 of 75, which was initiated by then the UN Commissioner for Namibia, Mr. Sean McBride, former Irish Foreign Minister, who was at that time the 1975 the UN Commissioner for Namibia.
At about that same time, the Council for Namibia was established. What was the purpose of establishing the Council for Namibia, and what did it actually do? What were its functions?
The Council was established earlier, in 1966.
Oh, that much earlier.
1966, the UN General Assembly, after the World Court had failed to give a clear ruling on the basis of which the UN would have done something to force South Africa out of Namibia. Out of frustration, the General Assembly said enough is enough. And by resolution, a historic resolution, very far-reaching resolution, 2248 of the General Assembly of 1966 terminated South Africa's mandate over Namibia. And following that, set up the United Nations Council for Namibia in 1967.
Okay.
And giving it a wide-ranging mandate, responsibilities, actually to proceed forthwith to Namibia, to establish itself inside in the country and to organize the people and to assist them and to organize elections and declare independence and to come back.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen. South Africans said, and the smart people as they were, they didn't challenge South Africa. So that situation existed until 1970. Mandate had been terminated. There was no way to kick South Africa out of the UN, and South Africa was in the meantime still in Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
Security Council was as a body, skeptical about the action taken by the General Assembly. Some members felt that the General Assembly had gone beyond its mandate in having taken such a far-reaching action. Some people were more legal. On the basis of that, in 1970, the Security Council collectively asked the court, because the situation went from bad to worse between 66. South Africa had its own reaction. It stepped up repression and imposed focus homeland policy, similar to what you had in South Africa, in Namibia. Angered by that, the court, the council, Security Council, decided to seek an advisory opinion from the court, from the World Court, something to the effect that given the fact that General Assembly had terminated South Africa's presence in Namibia, and given the fact that South Africa, in spite of that decision, continues to be defiant, refuses to comply, what can we do? And the court said that what the General Assembly did is legal, and whatever you can do within the competence of the UN Charter, you're free to do.
Now, have there been changes within the court that made of this reversal in approach to the situation?
Well, International Court, we elected new members today, this morning. Five additional members, some renewal of mandates, others new members, 15 members of the court. The court is supposed to be apolitical, but we know as a practical matter that court has very often been influenced by those who wield power. And certainly the ruling in 1966 surprised lawyers and, of course, frustrated the United Nations and utterly disappointed us, who had hoped that, given the fact that our case was so just, that the court would rule in our favor. But we are happy that in 1972, the American president of the court, not that he decided, provided leadership. Actually, the current president is also an American. No connection between the two things. Whatever had been done in the court, the outcome was far-reaching. The judgment was given in June 1971, in an advisory opinion, which has really gone much further than what the court used to do, not only on the Namibian question, but generally. So the responsibility that the Council for Namibia was given, it was a council of member states assisted by a commission appointed by the General Assembly. At the level of Assistant Secretary General. But when the Council could not proceed to Namibia, Council started setting up machinery here at the UN.
Okay.
And in the neighboring country, Zambia particularly, in Africa, to begin to implement those things that they could implement without being inside of the country. But among the things that the Council did was to provide the Namibians with travel and identity documents issued by the council, recognized by the member states. So I was traveling all over the world with the council for Namibia document. The council also set up so many different kinds of scholarship and training programs for Namibians outside. Council also, through the Office of the Commissioner for Namibia, started doing research into different aspects of Namibia's economy, of course, illegal activities of South Africa. Uh-huh. After the ruling of the advisory opinion of the court,
okay.
South Africa's presence in Namibia was declared illegal. So any action undertaken in Namibia by South Africa, any bad action, and all of them were bad, were deemed illegal.
Mm-hmm.
The council was also researching into what specific things South Africa was doing following the ruling of the court, and was submitting annual reports to the General Assembly for consideration and action by member states.
Mm-hmm.
The council in 1975 set up the United Nations Institute for Namibia in Lusaka, Zambia.
In Lusaka, yes.
Which now our Prime Minister was the first director.
Yes.
So that institute adopted a more focused program of training in selecting young people that we were training for middle level public administrators in different fields. Very successful program, a concrete example more than anything else of what the United Nations did to prepare the Namibian people for future responsibilities. As I say, I was a UN fellow.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us got UN fellowships, scholarships, and obtained education in different countries all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of education and training and assistance to the United Nations Institute for Namibia and some other facilities we set up for education and health, facilities in our camps in Zambia and in Angola, United Nations provided not only the Office of the Commissioner for Namibia, the UN Council for Namibia, but also the UN specialized agencies, WHO, UNICEF, UNESCO, UNDP, provided concrete material assistance to the Namibians under the care of SWAPO. The resolution that set up the UN Council for Namibia, among other things, proposed mandated the Council to proceed to Namibia. But in the absence of that, the Council was supposed to proceed to Namibia and to carry out its mandate with the fullest possible direct participation of the Namibian people themselves. The Council could not proceed to Namibia.
Okay.
So, instead of that, and SWAPO having been recognized by the UN, the Council consulted Namibians who were outside as refugees in the neighboring countries, the largest concentrations having been in Zambia and in Angola, to consult them, to involve them. The Council also did undertook some of the actions which independent Namibia virtually inherited, stop, lock, and barrel. For example, SWAPO was recognized as sole and authentic representative of the Namibian people as a permanent observer in the UN system. But there were some conferences, international conferences, the Law of the Sea, for example, and other conferences where we could not, as a liberation movement, represent Namibia, the country.
Mm.
The council was set up by the UN to do that. The council was virtually the government of Namibia. We were freedom fighters to liberate the country. So that enabled the Council of Namibia to sign certain treaties and conventions and protocols prior to Namibia's independence, of course, after consultations with me or with the other SWAPO leaders on behalf of Namibia. So when the Law of the Sea process started, for example, the Council of Namibia represented us. I was included in the delegation of the Council for Namibia. And the Council signed that. A number of other international agreements which reached at independence we inherit it and then accept it as valid international instruments that Namibia had in the deal.
That's very important
yes.
to the record, because
yeah,
that's
indeed.
Not
anything yes.
that's
yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. And the Council also, as part of its mandate, the Council had had powers to legislate in a form of adopting decrees. And one of the most important decrees which the Council adopted, prepared by the Commissioner for Namibia in consultations with myself and the other Swabu leaders, was a decree number one for the protection of the natural resources of Namibia. It was passed, and in the subsequent resolutions of the General Assembly and even of the Security Council later, it was illegal. Member states were prevented, prohibited, were advised not to engage in any legal relationship with South Africa, which may lend legitimacy to an illegal occupying regime in Namibia. Yeah. So that helped us to get through the General Assembly additional resolutions under which specifically your member states were prevented from fishing illegally in Namibia's waters.
Okay.
When the Law of the Sea Convention was passed,
yeah.
the Council of Namibia declared 200 miles exclusive economic zone for Namibia. When we went there, it was our first law in independent Namibia to ratify what the council has already done. And council produced many documents that are proved very helpful to us at independence.
Well, I wanted to ask you, this is sort of a complex analytical question, but you were able to achieve a great deal within the UN, a very unusual accomplishment, because there were other turmoils and other liberation movements in other parts of the world that never achieved what you were able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of leverage do you bring to bear to achieve this? In other words, how did you understand how the power structure worked, and how did you bring that together to make this happen?
Well, that's a question really that directly deals with me, and if I answer it, I'll be talking about myself.
Okay.
Because I was right in the center. I don't necessarily want to do that. But you touch on it. It's a question of understanding how the system operates. The United Nations operates not unlike U.S. Congress through networking. The United Nations is structured around regional groups. There is an African group, there is an Asian group, there is a Latin American and Caribbean group, there is Western European and other states group, and so on. Now also Eastern European group, since the collapse of the socialist system in Eastern Europe. So you get to know individuals before networking. You must know the key role players that are in each social setting. There are leaders and there are followers. So you get to know the key ambassadors. The chairmanship of the regional groups rotate on a monthly basis.
Mm.
But you get to know individuals, not because they are chairpersons. No reason why you should know the chairperson. But you get to know the individuals and they get to know you.
Yeah.
And on that basis, you provide them with information and appeal to them, request them to assist the adoption of particular resolution. When I became representative of SWAPO here, I wrote a letter to the office of the commissioner, a new one now, not the one that was dynamic, to ask for a ticket, because you would have recognized SWAPO, I was a SWAPO representative, mm-hmm. and I felt it was logical that they should pay for my ticket to for the Lusaka, where our headquarters was, mm-hmm. for consultations. And he wrote me that, back politely and said that there is no provision in the program of work of the Council of Namibia approved last year by the General Assembly. In other words, the request that you have made has financial implications that were not provided for in the, you know, I didn't mean that I know what this man was talking about. So I started asking people, say, well, you know, before money is spent, the General Assembly must specifically approve a budget for the council in which there will be a budget line. So what is, how do you do that? Well, you know, when we consider the next report of the council for submission.